It is Tuesday, and that means we get a chance to have a visit with a good friend of ours that's going to be on the air in just a second, and that is the one, the only, Dr. History. Good morning.
Good morning, Zeb. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm just glad the wind's not blowing like it was yesterday.
You know, I got to tell you something. I just thank the good Lord above that it wasn't any worse than what it was. I know a lot of people suffered home damage. I know a lot of people had trees uprooted. I know a lot of people had roofs damaged. I know that unbelievable the way one of my shorter haystacks just seems like it took a whirlwind and tipped that thing and tore it all apart.
Well, like I say, it was bad. I know there were semis tipped over, and yeah, there was a lot of damage done yesterday.
Absolutely. Well, you got through it, and I got through it, and most of our listeners did. But what is on your plate this morning to tell us about?
Well, I've got an excerpt from a book by a guy who spent about 20 years among the Indians.
Okay.
And so I'm just going to talk about some of his observations among the Indians and, you know, just kind of go through there.
Okay, you go ahead. You have the floor.
All right. Well, you know, whatever may be said of the Indians, you know, whether they were fighting their own people or fighting the white man, you can't dispute that they were pretty much courageous. They were some brave guys. And from his first contact with the whites until the last roundup on the reservations, they proved themselves to be born warriors, born fighters, and, like I say, for the most part, they were very brave. And they usually hesitated to attack until he was sure that he had the advantage. But that only proved that he was also shrewd or smart as a brave. I mean, the white men had the best of modern weapons, while the Indians, for the most part, still depended on the old bow and arrow or an old rusty gun or a pistol that didn't have much ammunition. So, But when fighting with other Indians on equal terms as to the equipments of war, those that had the greatest courage, you know, they won. So,
you know, they never did, and none of the tribes in history, and correct me if I'm wrong, but none of the tribes ever fought for second place.
Oh, no. No. You were either dead or you were number one.
There you go.
So, but, you know, fighting was as natural to the Indians as hunting. Mm-hmm. They were fighting among themselves before the white man came, after he came. And so they had traditions of warfare that went back hundreds of years with each other as well as, of course, with the white men when they came. And when fighting among themselves, they had some kind of rude military codes and regulations. They held war councils, and they planned campaigns or raids. You know, so they didn't just go into a blind. They had some plans. But it was not often that one Indian tribe surprised another, because the Indians instinctively feared an enemy on every side, and they were always on the alert. They had guards out, and before going on the warpath, a lot of them worked themselves into kind of a frenzy. They'd get into their so-called war dance, painted their face and their bodies, you know, the war whoops. The old people and the young people, they kind of cheered them on and eagerly awaited their return with goods or captives or both.
A lot of people have told me they've seen you doing the same thing outside your office on normal.
I only do that on really, really difficult pages.
I see.
But when the war party returned, its approach was announced by scouts, and the result of the adventure was related. Now, if the expedition had met with disaster, the names of the dead or captured were made known, and the women indulged in some pretty bad wailings and other signs of grief. Now, unless they were thoroughly crushed, the returning party did not admit defeat. But they had shouts of triumph. They brandished their weapons and their waving scalps or other trophies they might have taken. An imitation of the warlike scene was reenacted, and the exploits of the braves were rehearsed. If successful, the captives were sometimes spared and adopted into the tribe. Now, a captive man was rarely permitted to accompany a war party against their own people, for obvious reasons.
Right.
I mean, the warriors, fearing that this guy, you know, going against his own tribe, he's going to obviously try to escape and rejoin his tribe. So they wouldn't let him go against his own, but he would be part of their tribe, basically. So now, when they were condemned to torture and death, the sufferings of these captives were pretty bad. I mean, they had some pretty severe methods of tormenting these people, and kind of strangely, the women were kind of some of the worst as far as inflicting these tortures. And, of course, if the victim manifested an indication of weakness or cowardice, he was really treated badly. And a lot of times his suffering was prolonged and multiplied. Now, if on the other side he was brave and bore his torture, you know, pretty well, which they mostly did, it got the admiration of the tormentors and the tribe, and generally his bravery was rewarded by them putting an end to his sufferings a little quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when the Indian first encountered white man's guns, they thought it was kind of a superstitious thing. They didn't know what to make of this, what they called artificial thunder and lightning. And anyway, as civilization advanced to the West, they gradually, you know, got their own guns and became more or less proficient in their use, but really not very, very good. But they would get them from different traders that came through. Now, next to taking the scalp of an enemy, the highest thing that an Indian could do was his success in stealing horses. Now, when the merits of a brave were recounted by others, how good he was as a thief was considered by his tribe as almost as well as his exploits in battle.
Really?
And there was, for the Indian, a double incentive for stealing a horse. Number one, it gained for him the admiration and the wealth at the same time, but the more horses he had, the richer he was, and the more influential he was with his people.
Mm-hmm.
So a brave warrior also had a bunch of horses. So, but the North American Indian was not noted for his inventiveness. They were pretty much satisfied to just kind of exist the way that they had for hundreds of years. But there were several things that they invented that they were pretty ingenious in inventing that really never changed much. And that was the canoe, the moccasin, the snowshoe, the teepee, and the bow and arrow.
Got a question for you.
Okay.
And I've often wondered this. The moccasin. Okay, now that is not the warmest footwear you could ever wear. Did they have, the Indians in the old days, did they have like some kind of a stocking or something they put over their foot? I mean, my goodness, you'd freeze your feet off.
Well, you know, if you recall looking at some of the moccasins in the wintertime, those moccasins were more like, I don't know, I'd call it like a muckluck.
Yeah.
You know, they came up onto the calf, and I believe they had some type of fur on the inside as well.
Okay, all right.
But, you know, and I'll talk about that here in just a minute, but the Indians, you know, they roamed all over the country, and they used the rivers and the lakes to get around, and so the old birch bark canoe was the best thing for getting around. I mean, it was strong, it could carry a lot of things over lakes and streams, it was lightweight. So if they came to a falls or something, they could just portage around the falls because it was pretty lightweight. And it was generally used in the north and the northwest. Now, in the western plains, there were no birch trees. So they used these boats they called bull boats.
Mm-hmm.
And those were basically like a big tub that was shaped over some willows, and a hide was stretched, a green hide was stretched over it, and then when it dried, it was a bull boat, and they looked very awkward.
Uh-huh.
But they would actually leave the tail of the buffalo hide on, and they would actually tie three or four of them together, and sometimes they would use a horse to pull four or five or six of them across the river with their women and children and goods in them.
Well, now, wait a minute. Go back to the canoe for a minute, though.
Okay.
One can always say that maybe that wasn't the greatest invention ever that we got from the Indians, because if you ever tried to take care of one of those by yourself without tipping it over?
Actually, you're exactly right. One of those canoes, I mean, you just jump in one of those canoes that's not fiberglass and gotten from Cabela's. Yeah, they're pretty tippy.
Oh, my.
So, you know, the Indians, they got pretty skilled at taking care of those canoes. And the nice thing about the birch bark is if they were damaged, they were easy to repair because there was plenty of bark around. And they could actually carry sometimes several tons of freight besides paddlers and passengers. And they were used, of course, we know by the fur companies, the traders, the hunters, pioneers. So, obviously, they had to learn how to take care of a canoe as well.
Absolutely.
So, but the bull boat and the canoe, they were used extensively throughout throughout the Indian tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the moccasin I mentioned, you know, it was made of tanned deer skin and sewn with the sinews of the animals, and they'd use a like a awl or a sharp or bone or something sharp to make the holes. But if you think about it, in the summertime, a moccasin was elastic, it was soft, and but it protected their feet, but they could still climb, you know, mountains and hills, and it was easy to make and easily mended.
Okay.
So, in the summertime, it wasn't too bad. Now, getting to the wintertime, move ahead, the snowshoe. Now, it was a necessity for Indians in the Northwest, obviously, because they had to travel through deep snow to hunt game. But I don't know if you've ever tried snowshoes, Zeb, but...
Let me ask you a question. Okay. How many guys on crutches have you seen walking on snowshoes?
That's why I threw that out there. But I have tried them, and these Indians could actually run with snowshoes on. Now, I found it difficult just to walk with snowshoes on.
That'd be like a cow trying... Never mind.
Okay. Yeah, so snowshoes, but they were very adept at running and, hunting, you know, in the wintertime in deep snow.
Wow.
And really, you think about the snowshoes of today, they're really not much different than what they had years and years ago.
Okay.
Anyway, now, sometimes people have a picture in their mind of the stone war club as a weapon. And basically, the only time a stone club would be any good is if your enemy was laying on the ground in front of you. So the clubs were, they were common in Indian camps, but they weren't used in warfare. They were used to pound stakes in the ground and stuff like that. Now, it is true, however, that after a battle, sometimes the women would take one of those stone clubs and gently tap the heads of the enemy.
Gently tap the heads of the enemy.
Just mm-hmm. to kind of finish them off, I guess.
I see.
Say that.
Okay.
All right. So now some of the men actually started carrying a peculiar-looking club that had like nails in it or a long spike in it.
Oh, my.
But again, this was a club that they did not use in battle.
What was it for?
They were so close. So they carried these mostly for ceremonial occasions, just to show. So they really weren't used that much now. And then, of course, we get to the tomahawk. Once guns came into play, the tomahawk really wasn't used that much in warfare. It kind of went by the wayside. But now, if by chance an Indian met another in hand-to-hand combat, the weapon of choice was the knife.
Mm.
Now, so if you had two Indians that were fighting, it was with knives, and they were the bloodiest. They would stab and slash each other, and usually one died, if not both. And in fact, there was one case where this fellow that is telling the story says that these two guys were fighting, they both died. He said he counted in one, had 8 stabs and 21 slashes.
Oh.
The other one had 8 stabs and 14 slashes.
Wow.
And they were both dead.
You know, the thing is, right there, you hear so much about today with all the bacteria and everything and the infections. Really, you don't hear too much about stories about people getting infections or staph infections in the Old West. Why not?
Well, you know, we've talked about the medicine in the Old West.
Yeah.
With the Indians, and they had various things to treat burns and cuts and wounds, and some of the things we don't even know about today.
Well, did they, with their medicine men and everything, if they had one of the braves get cut in battle, did they know that how to stitch things up and sew things up?
They were very good at that. Now, I don't know about stitching, but I know that they... they used various things to prevent infection.
I see.
Better than, in some cases, better than we did as the white men.
Hmm.
So, but, and again, one of the most important things that they carried, both men and women, was a knife. And the knife was inseparable. I mean, that was what they used for slaughtering animals, scalping their enemies, general purposes. And, you know, knives were, they were kept sharp. They usually had handles that were decorated very nicely. In the early days, they, you know, the metal was difficult to find, but
yeah.
The white traders, they'd come by and the Indians were able to get metal and make their own knives.
I wish I could get a blade on a knife like they did back in the old days, and they didn't have any of the fancy stuff to use.
No, they didn't, but you can imagine, and I don't know exactly how they did it, but they kept their knives very, very well, sharpened. And,
right.
But now another thing they used was a lance, and this was used pretty effectively in battle. Because, it was something they could throw. It was something they didn't have to get real close to the enemy with. And here again, they got iron or steel from white traders.
Right.
So,
right.
Now, there's an old tradition that is kind of a false tradition that this guy talks about. He says it's claimed that some of the Indians used poisoned arrows. Now, this is something that, according to this guy anyway, that's kind of a false notion because, number one, if you try to get the poison or the venom from a rattlesnake, you may end up on the deadly end of that.
Mm.
And so if they ever did use poisoned arrows, it must have been pretty rare.
Now, we have, of course, I've got to jump in here and say this, we've seen Western movies that have shown, various Indian attacks, and the soldier gets an arrow in the arm, and all of a sudden it's a poison arrow, and boop, he's gone, type of thing. So where did that rumor get started?
Well, it did happen on rare, rare occasions, according to this author.
I see.
So, but, again, you watch Hollywood and TV, and it sounds like they were doing it all the time.
Well, what kind of poison did they use?
Well, he talks about rattlesnake poison, I suppose there's maybe other things that they could have used that could have caused infection.
Oh, okay.
And then we get to the bow and arrow. This was a work of art. The shaft of the arrow usually varied in length depending on the tribe. And that's why sometimes some of these scouts, like Jim Bridger and these guys, they could come upon a massacre and they could say, well, this was the Apaches or this was the Comanches or whatever, depending on what the arrows were.
I see.
But the end of where the feathers were, that could be anywhere from 2 to 3 inches long to as much as a foot long. And I didn't realize that they would put feathers that long on an arrow.
You got to admit that right there, and I know we're running out of time, but you have to admire the mental ingenuity of anybody in years gone by that would sit down and they just decided how to make fire, and then all of a sudden, Muckluck looks at Bad Luck and he says, let's make an arrow. I mean, they didn't know what an arrow was. How did they figure that out?
Well, and to get it to fly straight and true, and how did they figure out, okay, let's put some feathers on here to make it fly straighter. Now, and another thing is when an arrow went into you, you had a couple of choices here.
Oh, good.
Either to push it right on through or try to pull it out, which with the barbs on there, that wasn't a good thing to try to do.
And I thought my sciatic nerve hurt.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then the other thing is, the arrowhead was held in place by sinew, and if it stayed in there very long, that softened, and so you could pull the shaft out, but the arrowhead would stay inside of you.
Oh, how nice.
Which it did with Jim Bridger.
I see.
In fact, Jim had an arrowhead in his back for, several years.
Mm-hmm.
Until I can't remember who it was. He went to a rendezvous sometime, and there was a doctor there that cut it out of him.
Oh, my goodness. And I'm sure it was a gentle anesthetized operation.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what they used for anesthetizing, but I'm sure he drank a little of that.
Yeah.
But again, the bow of the bow and arrow was amazing. It was made out of hickory or willow or mesquite, and they were very strong.
Yeah, but there again,
to make them stronger.
There again, though, Doc, you got to admit that we could go on and on about this, and I wish we had more time, but you got to admit that where did the idea, the thought, the light bulb go on in somebody's mind 200, 300, 400 years ago to invent a bow and an arrow? Come on now. I mean, that's really amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And then, according to this author, for you and I to try to pull a bow back, pull the string back, you and I might get an inch, maybe 2 inches. The Indian would pull it back a foot or a foot and a half.
Wow.
So these were strong bows with, they were, the bowstring was really strong. It was made of, again, with sinew. And the Indian also protected his wrist And this is something I wondered about, too, because I don't think you ever see this in TV, but they had a wrist band, a leather band, so that if the bowstring hit their arm, it didn't rip their arm apart.
Oh, man, and that's what I do all the time.
Yeah. And now another thing is they weren't very good with firearms because they didn't practice.
Okay, we got a minute left.
Because, you know, so they weren't very good. I know we're getting out of time here, but the one thing, the Indians, they used to practice battles. But it was kind of a, you know, sham battle where they would ride around, yell, and do all this. And and it was more just for entertainment.
Oh, really?
Anything. But these Indians were amazing on horses. You know, they could take a horse, and all they had was a lariat attached to the bottom jaw of the horse. But they could make that horse just do anything they wanted. They could jump on and off the horse. They always got on the right side, or what we refer to as the off side.
Or the Indian side, yeah.
The Indian side, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and of course, in battle, of course, they could get on either side, jump off and on as easily as you want to. But they were experts also, and I didn't know this either, but they were experts with a rope, with a lasso.
I didn't know too much about, I did know of one tribe, I think it was in the Southwest, I want to say the Comanches, I think were very adept at roping, but I'm not sure that's the right tribe.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure either, but they could catch an animal around the leg, the neck, you know, any part, and they were good at it. And actually, the men and the women were pretty good experts at throwing a rope, throwing a lasso.
You know, I'm going to have to stop you. I hate to.
Right. But I'm done. I just finished.
Well, I'd really like to do some more on this because it's very interesting. And it just amazes me as to how somebody sat down one time at a fire and said, okay there, Tonto, we're going to invent a bow and arrow. And they went and did it. That's amazing. Listen, Dr. History, better known as Dr. Ken Turner, thank you. God bless you. I'm running late. I got to hurry. Right. But thank you, and we'll look forward to next week, and I'm sure you've already got next week ready.
I may have.
Aha!
You have a good day, Zach.
All right, see you later, buddy.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.